Welcome to I'm Spiritual, Damn It. I'm your host, Jennifer Weigel, and joining me on the line, I'm super excited. It's like I have Elvis on the phone, Dr. Mary Neal, author of the New York Times bestselling book, To Heaven and Back, and her new book, Seven Lessons from Heaven, How Dying Taught Me to Live a Joy-Filled Life. Hi, Mary. How are you?
I am terrific. Thank you.
Thanks for being. No, it's so great to have you back on the program. And I've spoken about you so often that it's almost like my son now knows Dr. Mary Neal. I mean, you are the celebrity in my household because of how we met. And it's such a wonderful circumstance that I feel is now a miracle, or as you would call, a nudge, which could be then led to a miracle. As many people who are listening to this might know, you had an out-of-body near-death experience when you were kayaking, and you were without oxygen for 30 minutes. And as a medical professional, because you're an orthopedic surgeon and a spinal surgeon, you know what it's like to not have oxygen for 3 minutes. It's
right.
Just, going to make you a vegetable. So here you are, no oxygen for 30 minutes, and you're a living miracle, and you experienced this time in the light. You were with Jesus. You got a lot of information about what it all means and miracles and circumstances. And when you and I met, you were coming to town to speak at the International Association for Near-Death Studies here in Chicago, Chicago IONS. And Diane Willis, the founder of Chicago IONS, reached out to me about doing an interview with you on your book, To Heaven and Back. And at the time, I was a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. And I said, look, I will interview you, but I can't guarantee that the Tribune will publish it. But I know I will publish it in my book, which is my third book, This Isn't the Life I Ordered. And you still came down. You said, I don't want to be in the media. If you put a gun to my head, I couldn't make up the story. I'm a pragmatist. But you listened to the nudge that you had to go downtown and do the interview, and you had to tell the story to all who would listen. And you told your story to me, and I put it in my book, and I tell it to everyone when I do a talk. You are part of every talk that I do, and I've had many since that day in 2012. So hopefully you know that when you have your life review, you'll see this ripple of how your story impacted so many, as you know, because being in the light, you had your life review, and you know what happens when you get there. You don't judge it, right? You witness it. You observe how the good and, quote, the bad affect others. So now on this journey with Seven Lessons from Heaven, How Dying Taught Me to Live a Joy-Filled Life, obviously you're still very aware of your surroundings and your spiritual life has deepened greatly from having this near-death experience. But I'm wondering how it's going for you in your scientific life, because as you told me, you were told in the light that you had to go back. As you say, you were kicked out of heaven. And I don't know how you cope with that when I say often there aren't enough therapists in the world to help me with that one. But you were told to come back and tell your story to everyone who would listen. And you go to hospitals and sometimes only one doctor will show up. And I'm wondering if now the crowds are growing to hear you tell your story.
Well, I would say that I've spoken to, at this point, many hundreds of thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to me because the medical field, and I would say our culture in general, still has this idea, and I might add that I believe it's a false idea, but they still buy into this false narrative that we've been given that you can either believe in science or you can believe in God. And one of the things that happened for me after I came back, I mean, I spent many, many months trying desperately to come up with an alternative explanation. And we can get into the reasons why, but at the end of my own research, of really more than anyone else on the planet trying to disprove my own account,
mm-hmm.
I realized the fallacy of this narrative. Because the reality is that science and spirituality coexist very easily. They address different questions.
Mm-hmm.
It's like saying you can have an apple or you can have an orange, but they're not both fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Fact is, science will always be the vehicle by which we try to understand how. How do things happen? And how can we change things? But spirituality is always the way we can address the bigger issue of why.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just totally different.
So, I have a question, though, about the word, like you say, God. I think maybe some people just get wrapped up in that word because so many people kill over that word,
It's like everything else.
Right.
We if we look at every single person on the planet, no matter what their position, no matter what their culture, no matter what their faith life, we share 90%.
Mm-hmm.
But we all focus on that 10% that divides us.
Right.
And you're right, language is part of that. I use the language that works for the way I communicate.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of the difficulties, because even when I describe these people that greeted me when I was in heaven, I'm always a little careful because I don't really know whether to call them people or spirits or beings, because we assign so much meaning to different words and we make so many assumptions based on different words that are chosen.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the fallacies. I know that one of the things that my experiences have done for me is to recognize that almost all of our existence is in the gray zone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's very little black and white. I mean, you have to have so much, whether you want to say take everything with a grain of salt or have more grace for people and situations. You know, we know and understand so little of what's really important. But we focus on all these little details instead of stepping back and just accepting the reality of thank you, God. Thank you for being in our lives. Thank you for showing us how to love.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, instead of living in a state of gratitude, it seems like we just want to focus on the nitpicky details of what divides us and what divides us, more importantly, from God, from that absolute sense of love.
Do you think that now, having had this experience and knowing that we are all connected, I remember when you said you were up in the light and you felt that unconditional love, and you even admitted that when you wrote the first book, you didn't give Jesus the props that he should have had.
No. Well, and part of it is for the exact reasons we're talking about now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know what I know,
mm-hmm.
and I know what is true, and I know what to be true. But in writing that first book, first of all, I didn't particularly write it for other people. I wrote it for myself, in that I sort of was checking it off the list of things I had to do, and I really didn't think people were going to be reading it. And so I really only included what I felt like including and what I thought was important. And when it came to actually making that statement that, no, actually, Jesus Christ was holding me and comforting me and reassuring me and taking me through my life review, the idea of making that public declaration seemed so outlandish to me, because I didn't then and I don't now deserve that.
Mm-hmm.
We live in this culture of reward and punishment. And so I knew that people would say, oh, well, who are you? Who are you to be held by Christ? But that's the beauty of it. I didn't deserve it. You know, we, those of us who claim to be Christians, claim that we believe everything written in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the New Testament says that we don't earn a position in God's kingdom. We don't earn love. We don't earn anything. We don't deserve any of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beauty of it, because none of us do.
And you even admitted to being more of like a casual Christian. I mean, you were raised Christian,
yeah.
But it's not like you were going on retreats every vacation.
No,
and you know,
as I look back on it now, I call myself a cultural Christian.
Sure.
Back in those days, mm-hmm. and you know, I certainly bought into the idea of being a good person and honest and ethical and a woman of integrity and all of those things.
Right.
And I did take my kids to church because I wanted them to have that same moral foundation.
Mm-hmm.
But that is very, very different than living your faith or being defined by your faith.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my faith is a part of every breath. It's a part of every heartbeat. And it's a part of every thought that I have. And that's a very different thing than, you know, what I was. And I would have said I was a Christian back then.
Yeah.
I would have said I was right there in the mix.
And so you also talk about, for those who aren't Christian, you know, do you think that a kid that was not baptized is going to hell because they don't even know what Christianity is? I mean, where you were, it wasn't like there was, you know, a Muslim zone over here. And it was just like this all-encompassing, loving, inclusive beauty.
I do not know the answers to all the questions. But one thing I know with absolute certainty is that God loves each and every person on this planet just as intensely as I already know he loves me. Mm-hmm. And I may not like that all the time, you know. I mean,
right.
You know, I'm not going to lie and say I love all people. I mean, they're a jerk. But even the people that I don't like are intensely loved.
Right. And even the people that are murderers. And I think about this a lot because as a parent, you know, anyone who does harm to a child, I feel like, no, they have no place in God's kingdom. But it's not up to us to decide, because as you learned, there's this thing that happens. It's this life review where you feel everything that you put out. I love some of the examples in your latest book about, like, I think it was a girl who saw when she was 5 years old on the playground and she teased someone, and she could feel all that shame that put on the person that she teased. And then another boy had reached out with some affection, and he had some challenges, and he was asthmatic, and he ended up dying at 17. And she, when she had her near-death experience, saw him and felt his love and understood, you know, enough, had nothing but love and compassion for this child.
One of the things I saw, mm-hmm. and one of the things that is true, is that when you understand someone's life story, when you understand their backstory, then it's not a matter of forgiving their actions, but through that understanding comes this incredible grace. And I truly learned what grace is. We talk about grace, you know, we use that word grace casually, like, oh, you know, I mean,
let's say grace, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
but when you really think about it, we always talk about forgiveness, mm-hmm. right? And when we talk about forgiveness, we talk about forgiveness, but there's always a second part to the sentence. There's always a but.
Mm-hmm.
I forgive you, but don't ever come back here again. I forgive you, but you're going to have to make it up to me. There's always a but. There's always a second part to the sentence. And what I realized is that with God, there's no second part to the sentence.
Mm-hmm.
It is, I understand what brought you to this moment in time where you hurt someone else or someone hurt you. I understand, and through that understanding comes incredible, pure grace, which is sort of forgiveness in action.
Right.
And I think that one of the wonderful things about really getting to the point of understanding grace is that we all have a backstory. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have, whether it's you're having a crummy day and so you're mean, you know, or you cut someone off in traffic or whatever, there's always a backstory. And what I discovered is that when you can acknowledge the backstory, even if you don't know what it is, mm-hmm. then all of a sudden you can have a sense of grace for that person and you can feel love. And where God's love is present, there really is no room for the destructive emotions of anger or rage or shame or regret or remorse or any of those things.
Right.
Because it's all okay.
And what about those fundamentalist Christians that are so judgmental? I mean, that's where I get bound up, right? I encounter people that tell me I'm going to hell just for interviewing people like yourself or mediums or psychics or intuitives or whatever. If it's something they don't understand, they have to put a label on it and tell me I'm going to hell. And I just have such a hard time with those people.
Well, I've been told I'm going to hell too, but the really great thing is, If where I went was hell, I'm okay with that.
Right.
Like, I'm good.
you've been there. They haven't. I think you know a little bit more about the program.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I don't know anyone else's life, but I do know mine, and I know where I'm going.
Yeah.
I'm okay with it. Mm-hmm. But I think that it goes back to what I was saying earlier, is that we're so much more comfortable focusing on what divides us.
Right.
Because when we try to reflect God's love to other people, it's challenging.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely pushes us out of our comfort zone. If we are going to try to love the people we don't like, and the fact is, we're not going to like everyone.
No.
I mean, there are, for whatever reason, whether it's personality or you know, whatever. I mean, we're always going to try to separate ourselves into groups.
Right.
And I feel sorry for the people, and I know plenty of them, who are so judgmental because they're missing out. They're missing out not just on the point that it's not our job to judge and all of those platitudes, but they're missing out on the joy that God intends for us every moment of every day.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what breaks my heart. Whether it's the evangelical judgment sort of people, or whether it's the people who just aren't willing to put out the time to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they break my heart just as much.
Right.
Because God intends for us to live in a state of joy, and it's possible.
Right.
You don't have to die. You don't have to have a near-death experience. I absolutely know that making a transformation from hope or faith to joy, which is based on trusting God's promises, is attainable for everyone. And it's liberating.
Right.
I mean, I think about the people I know who are most judgmentally dogmatic, and they're not particularly happy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're missing out. They're missing out on the whole point of the New Testament. The whole point of the New Testament, and if I call myself Christian, it's because, yes, the Old Testament is part of my history, but the fact is, I live in the New Testament. I live with a God that is a God of love.
Right. And that's an all-inclusive love, that, you know, everybody's welcome in that love. You know, and that's where, again, the categories, I'll love you and include you if...
Well, it's all conditional.
Right. You do this, 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 and this. You know, right. And the other thing, too, you talk about a lot in this, in the latest book, is how people can make that shift, right?
Absolutely.
Instead of just sitting around and thinking about it, you know, you say a lot of people don't discover their spiritual base until they're on their knees in desperation. But why not open up to it before you get to that point? Or if you are in that point, that's fine. Get there anyway. Look beyond, as you say, in step one, and forming a hypothesis with an open heart. Just these little nudges are
right.
going to get
and
you there.
I always like to equate it to buying an umbrella. You know, if I move to Seattle today, it may be a beautiful, sunshiny day, but you can be sure that I'm going to go and buy an umbrella. Because if I'm moving to Seattle, I can be guaranteed that it is going to rain.
Yeah.
And the fact is, part of our life's journey is facing challenges, setbacks, disappointments, whatever the stress. That is a guarantee.
Right.
And so my contention is that we're much better off trying to make this transformation so that when we face those challenges, we can still experience them with a state of joy, rather than being crushed.
Yeah. Well, I did a book club recently for my latest book, and I sat with a group of doctors, mostly. Almost all of them were medical doctors in some shape or form. And it was really interesting because I mentioned, of course, you and your book and your journey. And when I mentioned that you were told in the light that you would have to come back and help people handle the death of your son, that you were told your oldest son, Willie, was going to pass, and that you then were given that knowledge with, oh gosh, what, 9 years from when you came back? I believe he was 9 at the time, and he was 19 when he passed, but you were told he would be 18 when he passed.
Well, I wasn't given a specific age.
Okay, got it.
He told me 18.
He told you 18. Okay. So his soul knew that that was part of his journey, and yet here you were coming back with this knowledge, and it's like, no. I was just explaining to somebody how you were sort of shown by... in your dreams about the boy that changed places with Willie. Would you mind retelling that story to our listeners if they're not familiar with it?
Sure. When my son was very young, 4 or 5, we had a conversation about something, and I no longer remember the context of the conversation, but in it I said something about, well, when you're 18, and then finished the sentence. And he looked at me and he said, but I'm never going to be 18. And it pierced me the way he said it. And I said, what? Well, what are you talking about? And he looked at me in that way that only a young, just pure, sincere child can do. And he said, but Mama, that's the plan. You know that. And so I, you know, I never forgot that. It was a little creepy at the time.
Sure.
And then when I had my near-death experience and I was being sent back, I mean, at the time I was told that I had to go back, you know, I'm an assertive person. I said, no, I can stay.
I'm good. This is great. I feel great.
Exactly. And so as they were telling me this whole laundry list of expectations and things I still had to do on Earth, they did talk about his coming death and the expectations around that. And I did, of course, ask, well, why? You know, why my son? And this is a different part of the story, but I was immediately taken back to my life of you, where I'd been shown again and again and again and again the truth that beauty comes of all things. And then I was sent back, and every day I woke up wondering if that had been the day. I hadn't been given a particular date and time and mechanism.
Right.
It was clear this wasn't just a thought. I mean, it was clear that, no, this is going to happen, and this is how you're going to respond.
Right.
And then leading up to his 18th birthday, and I had thought his 18th birthday was sort of the deadline, so to speak, just because my son had said that.
Right.
And then leading up to his birthday, there were some things that happened that made me think the plan for his life had changed. Mm-hmm. Because certainly I prayed every day that the plan would change.
Sure.
And then very shortly before his birthday, yes, I had this, and I'll say it's a dream, but there are dreams and there are dream visitations.
Right.
And I didn't know what a dream visitation was at the time, but I absolutely know that spirits do come to us through our dreams, and it's not a dream. It is a spiritual experience.
Right.
And it's qualitatively entirely different from a dream. But I had this, quote, dream, and a boy who I didn't recognize, I didn't know him, a boy, you know, about my son's age, came to me in this dream and told me that he had traded places with my son, and then it was over. I mean, it was not a prolonged encounter. And I woke up, of course, feeling, on one hand, hopeful that, okay, maybe the plan did change, but then, of course, on the other hand, feeling very confused about, well, what does that mean? And what do you mean you traded places? And of course, feeling grief, like, but wait a minute, this is someone's son, and the whole thing.
Right.
And so I really went to work that day feeling very confused and conflicted. And I picked up the newspaper, and one of our local boys had been killed the prior afternoon in a very freak one-car accident.
Mm.
And when I saw his picture, I just couldn't believe it, because it was the boy from my dream.
Wow.
And I have to say, I mean, obviously I was grief-filled for his family, but at that time I thought, okay, well, the plan for my son's life really did change.
And you thought you were out of the weeds. Like,
I
okay.
Did. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, thank you, Lord. Like,
right.
Yeah, but he was given more time, but not the plan didn't really change.
Was it 9 months or less than a year from that?
Yeah.
Okay. And do you, you write about how you had just a couple of visitations with Willie, and you know that he went finally, and he said, I'm here now, and he went into the light, and you know, of course you know where he is, so that
yeah.
gives you great peace and comfort. But as you've admitted, you would do anything to be able to have dinner with him and snuggle with him on the couch. And
you know what? There's no question.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be reasonable. I have a different perspective than most people, of course, because
right.
I don't just hope that he's still around. I don't just hope that I'm going to see him again. But I have an absolute conviction. I mean, there's no shred of doubt. I mean, I think he'll probably be the first person to greet me when my own time is done, and he'll probably be asking me, you know, what took so long.
Right.
but obviously that gives me, I don't know if it's peace or comfort. It certainly allows me to set it aside a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, I love that boy and continue to love him more than I can imagine loving something else on earth. And I would give everything I have, everything I've experienced, I would do anything to have him back.
Mm-hmm.
Even just for, well, I mean, for another day would probably kill me, but
right.
I would, you know.
Right.
I mean, no, of course. I would rather have him here.
And yet, for anybody who's listening who's had a tragic loss like that, you know, it's so easy to go into that woe is me mode, right? And, well, what's the point? And I'm sad and I'm mad. I'm mad at God because this shouldn't have happened. And you were in the light of God and you were told this would happen. And so do you think, in your experience having been there to heaven and back, that we choose our families, we choose our parents, and that we have these sort of destinies so that we can learn this big grace?
I do think that we signed up for the gig.
Yeah.
I don't believe in predestiny.
Okay.
If every moment were predetermined, then there would be absolutely no point of our even going on this journey of life.
Right. What's the point of free will?
Free will. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do believe we are created beings. I do believe we're created in God's image, and free will is part of that. Intellectual curiosity is part of that. I do think the plan is almost like we have an outline for our life, but not a day-to-day plan, if that makes sense. No, free will is a big part of it.
Right.
But I do think that part of my passion in trying to encourage people or inspire people or motivate people to do the work of making this transformation to truly trusting God's promises is partly because we're all going to suffer loss. Mm-hmm. At the time of my near-death experience, I actually had not suffered any loss. I have now, and we are all going to suffer loss at some point. And loss is very challenging because it's the physical loss of someone there, someone you like, you know, picking up the phone and talking to them. And so there's this great loss, and it's very easy to sort of become stuck, become stuck in wanting to change reality, wanting to go backwards. But, of course, we can't go backwards. We can only take that loss and it becomes a part of who we are. It becomes a part of our future.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've made that transformation to truly believing that beauty comes of all events, and yes, there really is life after death, yes, you really are going to, you know, some people don't want to be reunited.
Right.
I have to tell you, I mean, when I talk about, you know, being reunited, there are people who tell me afterwards, look, I don't ever want to see that son of a gun again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you tell me my father's going to be there, I'm not going. I don't want to have anything to do that.
Right.
But that goes back to the most beautiful thing about grace. Because, again, if you took someone who hurt you terribly in your life and all of a sudden you truly understood their life story, then all of that disappears. All of that anger, hostility, resentment, all of those destructive emotions just resolve.
Yeah. Well, that's also true when I think about these random acts. One of the examples in your book is this person who was in a fire mentioning seeing this teacher that guided them out of the fire, which was actually not a teacher. It was an angel represented as a, you know, deceased aunt.
Yeah.
And so how come that child was saved from the fire, but then there was other death from the fire? You know, those questions have pop up for people like, why my child and not that child?
Yeah, but here's the thing. People ask me that all the time. Like, why me?
Right.
Right? Why did I, after 30 minutes without oxygen, why did I come back and I have no brain damage, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the most interesting part of that question is I have the exact same question.
Of course.
Why me? But I have it from exactly the opposite perspective. Because my question is, why did I have to come back? And other people say, why did you get to come back?
Mm.
And so you can ask that same question from diametrically opposed positions. And so when you talk about, well, whatever event. Why did that person die and this person didn't? Well, it depends on how you're asking the why.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
right.
Almost pretty much no one who's had a near-death experience has wanted to come back.
True.
There are people who have chosen to come back for various reasons, but that's different from wanting to come back.
Right. And, you know, you talked about having faith. And one of the things you've told me in our conversations is that faith is, you know, believing that maybe there's a God. And then something happens in life and you seem to shift into a trust that there actually really is something going on, maybe a nudge or a witnessing of something. But to get to the place of a knowing, which is where you are now, sometimes it takes a near-death experience or something incredible.
I totally disagree with you.
Really?
And I'm going to correct what you said just a little bit.
Okay, please do.
Because I believe it all starts with hope.
Hope? Okay, got it.
So hope is that state where you kind of hope it's true.
Uh-huh.
Because just like I hope it's sunny this weekend because I want to go skiing.
Right. Okay.
You hope something, but it's not necessarily based on anything.
Sure.
It's not based on fact.
Right.
And then things happen, and maybe it happens to friends or maybe a couple of things in your life, and then you sort of develop a faith that, you know what, actually, I kind of believe this is true.
Yeah.
And that's the beginning of faith.
Okay.
And I don't want to discount faith. I put different words on it mostly to make the point.
Yeah.
But there are definitely people who would describe their faith in the same way I would describe trust.
Okay.
But I separate it out mostly to make the point because I think faith is oftentimes based on the external.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on what you've seen in other people's lives. It's what you hear when you go to a church service. It's what you read in books, what you read in the Bible.
Sure.
But how many times do you hear people facing a challenge and their faith is shaken?
Mm-hmm.
Or they had a deep faith and then they lost it when their child died.
Sure. Sure.
But I think that's different than trust. Because when it's based on the external, it's always going to be shaky. I think it takes work, but I don't think it takes a near-death experience or other profound spiritual experience to make a transformation from faith to trust.
Got it.
And that's the transformation that's critical.
Mm.
And I absolutely believe that every single person is able to make that transformation, but it takes some work.
Yep.
You need to see God's presence and activity in your own life. And I absolutely believe every single person can find it.
Oh, yeah. You challenged me. You said get out a notebook and start taking notice of all those, quote, coincidences. And those aren't coincidences. They're nudges and God.
Right. And at some point, and that point is different for each person.
Yep.
But at some point, you're going to see enough activity in your own life and in your immediate environment that it's then that you go, wow, you know what? I don't just think this is true. I don't just choose to believe that it's true, but I have seen it, and I choose every day, throughout every day, to continue to trust that it's true.
Right.
Because when you make that transformation, that, I believe, is where life radically changes.
Mm.
It's so liberating, because if you can accept grace, if you can accept the fact that you are intensely loved, every part of you. You don't have to hide parts of you.
Right.
You are loved. You are, whether you want to call it forgiven or whether you want to just accept grace, if you can accept that,
right,
then you can forget about yesterday. You know what? I blew it yesterday. I blew it this morning. And that's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't need to keep beating myself up about it. I don't need to feel regret. I don't need to feel shame. I don't need to let my past or what someone else did to me in the past define who I am right now, because I am loved and I accept grace. So if I can eliminate all of those destructive emotions from yesterday,
right,
and if I can accept that there's life after death, and if I can accept that miracles really happen, that God is really present in our world, that miracles really happen, and there really is beauty that comes of every event, which I can assure you is true, and if you do the work of writing things down, you will be able to assure yourself. If you can accept both of those things, both the fact that the past doesn't define my present, and I don't need to worry about the future, because whatever's happening, beauty is going to come of it, then it frees me to live fully right now. I can be present in every moment of every day, and that, I believe, is what allows me or anyone to truly live in a state of joy. And that's not that I don't plan for the future. I mean, obviously, I do plan. We all have to plan.
Sure.
But I hang on to every plan very loosely, because I know if I'm facing struggles, even in this moment, if I'm facing a struggle, if I'm facing loss, I can still experience incredible joy, if for no other reason than the joy of knowing that this challenge I'm facing today is changing me and beauty will come of it. Because
yes.
We can all look backwards. I can look at myself. You can look at yourself from 10 years ago and think, oh, my gosh, boy, I've changed a lot.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we judge ourselves, too, for what we did in the past.
Exactly.
And
intellectually, we know that 10 years into the future, we are going to be different.
Right.
But there's no way today to predict how we're going to be different. But we will be different based on the challenges we faced.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think making this transformation to trust, and it's a daily choice.
Right.
And it's not, you know, you choose it once and you're good.
You know, as you're talking right now, a crisis of trust is the headline that just came up on the monitor in front of me.
Goodness.
See, isn't that a wonderful little wink?
Yes.
Because the monitors, that was fabulous. You just said the words and it popped up on the screen.
Oh,
and what are the chances that I would look up at the screen right this moment?
Oh, that's funny. I love it.
I do, too. And that's an example.
That happens. When you make that transformation,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden... And not everything is a miracle, don't get me wrong. I mean, there are coincidences. But when you make that transformation, all of a sudden, your awareness increases.
Mm-hmm.
It's like everything else. If I told you a funny story or an interesting story about red cars, all of a sudden, over the next week, you would look around and think, oh, my goodness, I never knew there were so many red cars on the road.
Right.
And it's the same thing. Once your awareness of God's presence and God's miracles increases, all of a sudden, you start seeing them.
Right.
And you start thinking, oh, wow, how did I miss all this in the past?
And that's what you taught me. I started taking notice of all the heart-shaped things in my life the day after I met you. And you said to Mark, you know, somehow keep track of it.
Right.
So I started taking pictures on Instagram and Facebook and posting them. And I'm finding them in you know, blobs of bird poop. I mean, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Listen, my son... when he was hit and killed, his body landed in this field of wild alpine roses.
Right.
And it's a long story, but this is now a number of years later, and every single place I go in the world, doesn't matter what the climate, if that place is or becomes important in our family's life, I will be guaranteed of seeing at least one single alpine rose.
Right.
I mean... you can't make that up.
No. And that's the other thing, too. I have a story. I was recently moving, and I was really sad to have to get rid of a piece of furniture that was an antique. It was an heirloom of my grandmother's. And I was just really torn about it. And I had to call an antique dealer, and he was kind of, you know, kind of giving me some problems with the price. And I just thought, okay, I was praying to my grandmother, like, help me out here. I need a sign that it is okay to get rid of this piece. I know you're not in the furniture, Virginia, but I really need... My grandmother's name is Virginia. So the guy comes in from outside, and he looks around, and he says, have you ever noticed that you have so many Virginia bluebells?
Oh, you're kidding.
I've never had them before in my yard. Now, I'd lived there for 7 years, and there was never one bluebell.
Right.
And I didn't know they were called Virginia bluebells. But suddenly, there was a field of Virginia bluebells, and he said, you know what? Now is the perfect time to relocate them.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was like, my friend just goes, did he just say relocate Virginia?
Oh.
I mean, it was literally
that's great.
Wow. And so, now, some people would have just said, oh, it's just a coincidence. But to me, I was praying for a sign,
right.
And this man spoke it.
Exactly.
And he was then he was not an angel where he popped out of the clear blue sky, and you write a lot of examples about that in your book, because he obviously is a gentleman who owns a store, and he's got, you know, he existed, but he was used as a channel to help me along. But there are stories after story after story of people who magically appear out of nowhere. And you talk about some of those in your book, where one woman was, you know, she saw sort of a seedy guy and she prayed, please God, don't let him hurt me. Please God, you know, she got home, she heard that there was a rape right in the area. She called the police and asked if she could help maybe with the identification just to see if it was the same person. And sure enough, it was. That person was then asked, why didn't you attack this lady? And he said, well, why would I attack her? She had these two guys on either side of her.
Exactly.
And they weren't there.
Yeah, and those are amazing stories. And it's a funny thing because I'm still cynical.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm cynical about people's stories because there are, sadly, but, you know, the fact is there are many people who tell stories that have other agendas.
Sure.
And there are a lot of stories that turn out not to be true. But it's amazing to me how many stories come out that are similar to that all over the world that have nothing. There's no agenda. There's no gain for the person. There's no reason for them to make something up.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's stories about someone in the United States all of a sudden praying for someone's safety in, you know, France.
Right.
And their friend calls up and says, oh, my gosh, you're never going to believe what happened. I mean, there are just hundreds of thousands of stories. And at some point, you just have to accept that you may not understand them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I certainly don't understand how it works. Like, why in the world would this guy tell you about the Virginia bluebells? But the fact is, okay.
Yeah.
Just accept it.
Right. And I also
just be grateful. Just say thank you.
Right. And the nudges, you talk a lot about that as well. Like, and they're not an anvil over the head. It's like this little urging, like the time when you were just thinking, I should stay home. And then you suddenly get a phone call from the agent that says that they want you to be on TV, but they never check emails before 11, but they did that day.
Oh, no, exactly. And those nudges, they're so common.
Yeah.
And of course, you always have to, you know, double check and like, is that really a nudge or is that just what I feel like doing?
Right. Right. And that's a tough one too, because you're like, okay, let me go back into getting out of my ego. Right. And getting back into trusting the process. And like you taught me to think of the penny and God, we trust you get up and you trust that you're going to be guided where you need to go. Of course you plant the seeds and you set the foundation and you know, you don't just sit on your couch and wait for the phone to ring, but you do go where you're guided to go. And if somebody calls out of nowhere, you go.
Exactly. I think the most difficult thing for most of us, even if we want to say, yes, you know, send me, I'll go where you lead, even if that's what we want to say, I think the most difficult thing is when we're being called, we're being nudged, we're being shoved, but we still, it's not necessarily something that we feel excited about doing because maybe it's pushing us out of our comfort zone.
Mm.
So we keep saying, no, that's not a nudge. No, not talking to me.
Right. And didn't this happen with you where you missed an opportunity to tell someone how important they were to you?
Totally. Yes. And I try to remember that every day, actually.
Will you tell that story to the listeners?
Oh, it's heartbreaking, personally. There was a classmate of mine in high school who was just the most really godly woman, even in high school. And it's not that she was a religious zealot, but she was everything you would hope to be in terms of loving and kind and compassionate. And I met her at a time in my life when she had this out-of-proportion impact on the course of my life.
Hmm.
And we all have those people. I mean, we barely know them, but they made this huge impact on us. And she was one of those people to me, and she radically changed the course of my life. For the better, I might add. And then, you know, we graduated from high school, and that was that. Lost track. And I kind of connected with her once over the years. And I won't tell you how old I am, but I've been out of high school a long time.
Yeah.
And
me too.
And a couple of years ago, I was really sort of overcome with this feeling of, look, I really want to track this person down. And I didn't know where she lived or anything, but I wanted to track her down and really tell her how important she had been in my life and how much I appreciated her and really just shower her with gratitude and love. And it was really this pretty overwhelming nudge.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I at the time I sort of thought I would have said that I was pretty good at responding to nudges, but I did respond in the sense that it took some doing, but I did track her down. I tracked down a Facebook page. And then I thought, okay, well, I will write a letter and send her a private message on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started writing it. But, of course, now that I had tracked her down, I thought, oh, you know, I'll do it later. Because doing that sort of thing isn't necessarily in my nature.
Sure.
I mean, I hadn't seen her in 30 years. Why would I randomly send a person this kind of a letter? And so I kind of put it off. And finally, I just said, no, I need to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sat down and I just kind of poured everything out into this message. And then I logged on to Facebook to send this to her. And discovered she was in the hospital, intubated, and she died a couple days later. So she was never conscious. She would never have been able to read my letter. And this had been very quick. It was over a period of a week that she was hospitalized and died. And I don't have regret in the sense that I have the same grace for myself that I know God has for me, but I try to hold that in front of me as an example of, look, you blew it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? When you feel those nudges, go with it.
Make the call. Do it.
The time is today.
Mm-hmm.
Time is now.
Right.
The time isn't next year or this afternoon. I have had so many times when I've been thinking about someone, and as a result really of this, have said, okay, I'm going to send them a text or I'm going to call them quickly and say, look, I don't know why I'm thinking about you, but hey, hope everything's good and, you know, I'm praying for you.
Yeah.
And I cannot tell you how many times I've had a responding text saying, wow, mm-hmm. I was just admitted to the hospital because I have pneumonia or, you know, some issue. And it's remarkable to me how little effort and time it actually takes to reach out to people like that,
mm-hmm.
and how much impact it can have.
And now you know, of course, that she knows how
yeah.
you feel because she's there and you know
yeah.
where she is and
Absolutely.
All that. But
yeah.
And the other thing, too, I just recently had a conversation with Dr. Jeffrey Long, as I know you're familiar with his work with the Near Death Experience Research Foundation. And we were discussing how it's important for people who are listening, if you are in a downward spiral, that, you know, ending your life isn't the answer because, oh, it's so great over there. You know?
Exactly. Nope.
And in your experience, do you ever get asked that question as you go throughout your travels to promote your books and to talk about your near-death experience?
Yes, I am asked that question
mm-hmm.
because there's no question that I can hardly wait to go back.
Right.
Yep. I mean, that is our true home.
Right.
There's no question. But it is also an incredible opportunity to come here to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not one to be squandered. And we each have incredible work that we can be doing and should be doing and really should be about doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be doing because that's the reason we're here. And so, no, you know what? I'm looking forward to the time when my work is done. And even though I will absolutely say that I live in a state of joy, it's not that I'm happy all day, every day.
Right.
Happiness and joy are two very different things. I mean, I still have struggles like every person on this earth. But, no, ending your life is really not, you're missing out on this incredible opportunity.
Right.
Basically.
Exactly.
And so even when people are facing significant struggles, and the fact is, people do.
Right.
I mean, I've certainly faced a lot of challenge in my life, but I know there are other people that face more challenges or more prolonged challenges. But even in that situation, you can still experience grace, you can still find hope, and more importantly, you can still make this transformation to trust.
And just as you're saying that, crisis in trust at an all-time high. There's a crisis, rather all-time low. The crisis is at an all-time high, is the headline on CNBC. So I think our conversation is very timely in the sense that anyone who's listening needs to try to find that transition from first hope, then faith, then into trust. And then if you're blessed enough to get to an absolute knowing such as yourself, that's the ultimate goal. And it comes with practice. It comes with baby steps. It comes with finding that heart shape or following that nudge or looking for that rose bush. Because as you know from having been there on the other side, it is all connected. We are all connected.
Right.
We are the oriental rug, as you say. There's light and there's dark, and it looks beautiful from up there. But from down here, it feels kind of awful, like we're getting stepped on.
You know, here's the other part of that is there are many people who would say, I want trust. But first of all, they don't necessarily want to do the work to get there.
Mm-hmm.
But second of all, don't necessarily want the responsibility of using that to benefit other people.
Mm.
I mean, I see that not infrequently when we talk specifically about near-death experiences. A lot of people want the experience, but they don't want the responsibility that goes along with it.
Mm.
And it's sort of this interesting thing, because if you make that transformation to trust, then part of that transformation is recognizing that, first of all, every moment counts.
Mm-hmm.
Every decision, every human interaction actually matters. And you need to be reflecting God's love. You need to be helping other people on that journey. And a lot of people don't necessarily want that responsibility.
No, they don't. I mean, you even mentioned that from having the knowledge that you might lose your son, you know, you just tried not to sweat the small stuff. It was about having real genuine interactions and connections versus eye rolls about, oh, you did this again? What the?
Yeah.
You know, it might be the last conversation you have, and then what?
Right.
So we really have to be present in those little bitty moments, because those matter just as much.
Absolutely.
Oh, well,
they matter, and they actually matter even more, frankly, because it's those small moments that turn into the big experience. It's that whole, you know, that whole saying of, you know, a journey of 1,000 steps begins with a single step.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't make that single step, you never go forward. You never, you know, people want to be at the top of the mountain, but they forget that to get there, you have to actually make those steps to climb.
True. I tell people it's like running a marathon. You can't just suddenly go out and run 26 miles. You got to train for it.
Yes, exactly. Right. There's no question.
No way. Well, Seven Lessons from Heaven. I'm holding it in my hot little hands. How Dying Taught Me to Live a Joy-Filled Life. Mary Neal, if people out there listening want to learn more about Dr. Mary Neal, just go to her website, which is spelled drmaryneal.com. Get the book. I highly recommend it. It's a great gift also for others who might be struggling. But even if you just haven't gotten yet to that trust zone and you think you have some faith, let's bump it up a notch, everybody. And remember, those small moments make such a difference. Dr. Mary Neal, thank you so much for being who you are and spreading your message to everyone who will listen.
Such a privilege. Thank you very much.
I'm so grateful. And everyone out there listening, treat others the way you'd like to be treated and stay spiritual, damn it. I'm Jennifer Weigel. We'll talk to you next time.